cause number 1322367CR, Carlos Gabriel Chumacero versus the State of Texas.
And may it please the court, and may it please, I guess I know Mr. Pena, and nice to meet Ms. Silva, and I do thank y'all for the opening, the opportunity to do an oral argument. I was telling counsel before this that you need 5 oral arguments to be able to apply for a specialization, and it's been almost impossible to get that number 5, and this one should put me over the top.
Oh, there you go. Well, great.
Let me talk to you about the issues that I've brought, and I brought just 2 issues today, and I think both of them really deal with the interpretation of the Court of Criminal Procedure. And one deals with venue. And I will tell you that the recollection that I have from the early 80s of Warren Burnett standing outside of a courthouse in San Antonio saying, how can this be fair? They've tried, the man who was murdered is Judge James Wood, and here we are standing in front of the James Wood courthouse in San Antonio when he was defending Charles Harrelson, who was Woody Harrelson's dad, who was accused of that murder. And in this case, we have a situation in which Mr. Chumacero was tried in the same courthouse in which there had been a memorial blood drive for Gabriel McFarland, who was the high school sports hero who had been killed out on the street in a shootout. And we've enumerated all of the evidence that was presented. I didn't try the case. It was tried by a recently retired district judge from Brownsville, who was trial lawyer on the case. But they brought in, and I've enumerated all that on the brief, extensive information about what the publicity was like over and over again leading up to that trial, and the ways that it affected both the jury selection and even the trial itself. Always had references. Hardly anybody involved in the case in any form was not familiar with the young man who was killed.
Mr. Stapleton, may I ask you a question about that pretrial process? Was a full-blown evidentiary hearing conducted?
2 were.
2. And so the only thing that was pending was a ruling on the motion to transfer venue.
That's correct.
Everything was heard. The defendant put on all evidence he wanted to, and state filed controverted affidavits.
That's correct.
Okay. Because there seems to be a difference in the case law that's been cited in this area. It makes a difference if a hearing was granted or not in terms of whether there's error in carrying the decision solely based on the qualification of the jury. But go ahead and proceed.
There were 2 hearings, full-blown hearings, and with different defense lawyers. The first one involved a judge who began hearing the case. And then when Judge Elia Cornejo Lopez came in as defense attorney, it was pretty clear that they were butting heads. She filed a motion to recuse. I'm not sure if she recused herself or got out, but at any rate, they'd had a full hearing. She wanted another one, and the trial judge gave it to her, and they had a full hearing. But he continually, it's all cited in the record, would say, I won't decide this pretrial. Let's see if we can get a jury or not. And so
when the judge ultimately did deny the motion, was it solely based on the qualification of the jury?
It was because he was able to put a jury in the box.
That's it.
That's it. And that's what he claimed, and that he made no secret of that. Now, I think that, and I suggest that from the rules, is gotta be error, because If that is the standard, there would never, ever be a transfer of venue. There would be, you're always going to be able to put a jury in the box if you have enough jurors to choose from.
And let's assume for argument's sake that it is error. Then our next step would be to review the record for harmless error. So in this case, the state has argued that it was had been 3 years since the murder took place. It was in a different community, so to speak, sent in a smaller community within the county. And there were very few people in the pool that remembered the incident, that knew the family, that had given blood, all of that. So how do you respond to the argument that the state has made in that regard?
Well, first, Sinton is county seat, and both from the sports activities and from everything else, it's an important place in San Patricio County. It does have a small population, but I would urge that if you have a murder in Los Fresnos or that it's going to be noticed in Harlingen and in Brownsville, and if you have a murder in Premeta, it's going to be noticed in Raymondville. I would say that that doesn't separate it out. Now, it's true that there were about a half a dozen, and I named them all and got the responses in the brief, who said that they knew about it. But then, even with extensive knowledge, they would then claim that they could be fair. And so we're going to have a group that are being put into the box that time later. And I would urge that whatever time passed, it was not enough. What we're going to have is a trial that's affected all the way through. And we did see that. And I put those instances in the brief as well, because what they did was we had people involved in the case. We had the father of a co-defendant who was interfering in the case as we went along. We had all types of involvement in Sinton, in the same courthouse in which the blood drives had been taken. There would have been no way to get away from it. The police officers who did the investigation knew the young man. Almost everybody who was interviewed had studied with his mother in school. She was a teacher. And so I would suggest that if ever an unfair jury can be harmful, this would be the type of case. It would be hard to design a case in which there would be fewer unfair instances going into it. Harmless error is always I would say it's the King's X way out. Well, yes, it was error, it was terrible, but it was not harmless. And I would suggest to you that an unfair jury, even if it's just one person on there, is not going to render it fair. And then we also have the instances that are named in the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, in which when somebody has been videotaped and their confession played, then that's not harmless in that instance. We had that in this case. He was all over the place as far as having made a statement. And I would urge that there's no way for a harmlessness to be there if ever you're going to have a fair trial. I think we can all think of cases where venue was moved with less egregious facts than this. And you know, the burden of us being able, jurors who are going to say they could be fair in the first place are not going to come back later and say that they acted unfairly as a result of that. So I would urge from all those bases that there was just no basis to get a fair trial in that instance. And really that sort of segues into the second argument that I would make, in that that 58-second confession that was taken by a co-defendant who'd been released from jail earlier that day, who then goes out 1 a.m. and gets an exonerating statement about himself from this young man who'd been a special ed student, and contrary to the father's statement of the description of the shooter, which would have described Champ Gonzalez, who was the one that went and took the statement. And so, and the judge comments on it, the jurors commented on it, there was delay. I think everybody felt like that the wrong people had been prosecuted. Now, it may have been that they would have been able to get Mr. Chumacero under some rule of parties theory, but I think a fair reading was going to be that he was not, in fact, the shooter as he had confessed. Yet this confession first was played all over the media, and then it was admitted into trial, and then it was argued by the prosecution as far as his statement that he was, in fact, the shooter, when he almost certainly was not, from all the other evidence in the case. And so that decision was short-circuited, too. And in both of these cases, I think it was an experienced trial judge who had an opinion about how to do things. And in these two instances, I think the opinions were harmful and ran contrary to the rules of criminal procedure, in that he says, all right, I'm not going to consider, and I'm talking about issue number two now, he says, I'm not going to consider the voluntariness of it because it was not state action. Of course, it became state action later when they offered it into evidence, but the taking of it was by the co-defendant who rousted the young man out at 1 a.m. in a distant city. And so he wouldn't consider it. And I would urge that that's just contrary to what the statute provides for. That was argued twice by the prosecution. It was accepted by both judges. What I would suggest is that that confession should not have come in either. And I can't think of anything more harmful than a confession that has come in that instance. And so on both of those instances, we think there was error and harmful error.
But let's, it's not clear what the basis was for him, sustaining your objection to it, but let's say that, as I understand, state action is required for it to be a constitutional violation, which clearly we do not have here, but there can still be a violation of the statute in and of itself. But as the state has argued, the trial judge was entitled to judge his credibility in giving the statement as to whether it was voluntary or not, because you have argued that there was a threat, I think, that he was under threat or duress. And yet he seemed to, I guess it was, the state has argued it was not raised until there was a fourth lawyer involved. And prior to that, he had said nothing about being under threat. So how do we factor that in? If the judge is, entitled to judge the credibility, we can't really step in his shoes there.
Well, I think at the very minimum, we should have been entitled to some findings of fact on that. My reading of what he said is that he was not going to reach the finding of voluntariness because there was no state action. I mean, that's okay. The judge states it. And so I think we don't have any clear indication that voluntariness was determined. And it's a development of that voluntariness, I think, would be hard to say if a co-defendant rousts you out in the middle of the night, takes a 59-second confession, that it's all going to be a voluntary activity. especially with their prior relationship, which is enumerated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to thank you for asking for or granting oral argument. I can't think of very few hours of my life which have been finer spent than the hour I spent previously with Mr. Stapleton and his lovely, elegant wife. I have great respect for people who advocate ferociously for their clients, but don't make it personal with the opposition, and that regardless of the court's ruling, we'll walk down today shaking hands.
Mr. Stapleton has a long reputation for being
And I'm an admirer of his already. Regarding...
Not to say you're old.
Experienced.
That's right.
Regarding the venue, my understanding of the law is that there are two ways for that to be determined and ruled on, and one of them is to have hearings on it, and the other is, well, let's see if we can select a jury, and the courts, I think, have held either way is fine. And this particular case, defense had the opportunity to present their affidavits. The state had their controverting affidavits, as the court has mentioned. And I think the case law has held that even extreme publicity in and of itself is not enough. I think I pointed out in the brief that Sinton is one of five or six cities in the county of San Patricio, and the jury selection encompasses people from all of those cities, including Portland, which is, I believe, is a bigger city. There were about approximately 150 members of the panel, and from what I could count and collect and document, it looked like there were nine challenges for cause granted. And of the questions asked during voir dire, only one person said they were here to do justice for the victim. No one else admitted or when questioned said that they were present at the blood drive, they knew them personally or had some type of vested interest in the outcome of the case. Those one or two people who did were properly challenged for cause, and the defendant was able to protect his rights through the challenge for cause process. So I don't see the any error, quite frankly, at all. I think the procedure was followed by the judge. The judge heard the witnesses, and one of them was the sheriff that the defense had called. And the sheriff pointed out, well, this was three years ago. There was a lot of publicity at the time, but it wasn't publicity at the time of trial. And I think a lot of us are creatures of recency. And what happened 3 years ago, a lot of people will forget. So I don't think there's anything in the record, certainly, that would support any error or to show that the court abused his discretion.
Well, except that as I read the case law, it seems to suggest that it cannot be the sole basis. The qualification of the jury, seating of a jury, cannot be the sole basis for denying the motion to transfer venue. And that seems to be what happened here.
It's always helpful when a district court, and this was a retired judge, Honorable Sid Harlan. It's always helpful when they articulate every reason for his or her ruling. What we do know and what the record shows is that he did hear the evidence and he did hear everything and allowed the defense to put on for a second time their arguments and played the videos, the news clippings and what have you. So that was in his That was introduced. They were not denied the opportunity. That was in his mind. Now, he did wait until jury selection. So I don't think we can definitively say that it was just jury selection. I would argue that he had the opportunity, at least, whether he articulated that or not. I'm not going to sit here and say that, but he at least had the opportunity to consider all.
And that does seem to be a distinction in this case versus some of the case law that I read where a hearing was not even allowed. He didn't, you know, the evidence was filed, but the judge didn't have a hearing and then decided to wait until the jury was seated, then denied. And in that case, there's, you know, error has been found.
Yes, ma'am.
And then go to the harmless analysis. So, That was the reason for my questions on the procedure that actually took place here.
I understand.
It's a big record. I tried to go in and find the transcript.
Looking at the appeal, it seems like 2/3 of it was based on the change of venue and that argument. I get it, in the hometown of where the victim is, and and I understand why it would be moved. I just don't think there's evidence to support the proposition that they were harmed, and that'd be my argument. The other issue is the taking of the statement by the defendant. And there's no evidence to suggest that was suggested by the police, that he was acting as an agent of the state. This is something that he did on his own. Hey, my backside's in trouble, and I'm going to do something because I don't necessarily going to rely on the police to investigate this. I'm going to go get this himself. And so he went and took matters in his own hands and got a statement from Mr. Tumacero. Defense, and Mr. West, actually, for the state, did a good job in cross-examination of pointing out through Mr. Chumacero's testimony that lawyer number one wasn't told, lawyer number two wasn't told, lawyer number three wasn't told about this threat, that the threat did not come into existence until lawyer number four had entered the fray, as it were, and the judge, as the court, I believe, has already stated, was free to make a determination of the credibility demeanor. It's one thing for us to look at the transcripts, but that judge that was there could make a decision of that. And of course, part of that is the defendant's criminal history. His prior aggravated assault comes into play, which is brought out. The jury heard the same evidence. So not only did the court hear the evidence, the jury was presented with the same evidence about the tape itself. So the jury was also given the opportunity to disregard, to believe it. If the jury had chose to believe it, you had 12 citizens who could say, or as we all know, it only takes one to say, you know what, I just don't like how the statement was taken, and I'm not going to consider it. That was out there for them to do, but they witnessed the defendant testify. They witnessed Mr. Gonzalez testify.
What did Gonzalez say was the reason that he took this upon himself to get the statement?
I don't recall, Your Honor, what he said. The exact reason was, but when you're charged with murder, and you're in a smaller jurisdiction, and I don't want to demean in any way smaller police districts, but sometimes there are less experienced officers, and some people take matters into their own hands. Now, I don't advocate, I would never advocate for someone to go do that, but it wasn't at state request or state action, which I think is the really at the heart of the issue.
Determination of a constitutional violation, yes, it has to have state action or government action, but you can still have a violation of the statute in of itself, can't you, and have, but not be a constitutional violation.
Well, my understanding of 3822 applies to government action and the requirement of the voluntariness of the statement would imply some type of government involvement or action. So for it to be a violation of the statute for voluntariness, it would accompany or would require some type of state involvement. And this was a private citizen that was doing the action. And there's that line of argument, but there's also the, I think as Mr. Stapleton would refer to it as the King's X argument, is at the time of jury trial, the defendant's lawyer did not object. So when the state offered the video into evidence by saying he did not object, I think that effectively waived that point of appeal.
Even though there had been the pretrial rulings on it?
From looking at Rule 103, which is what I think counsel stated, there are two ways of doing it. One is by making an objection, and the other one is to have a hearing outside the presence of the jury. Well, to me, that by its very nature says that there's a jury in existence at the time. So all these trials were held pretrial. There's not a jury in the box. So once there was a jury in the box, there was not a request for a separate hearing outside the jury. There was simply a statement of no objection. I do have a case, Court of Criminal Appeals, 248 Southwest 3rd, 194, Holmes v. State of Texas, or copy to council, and I have copies for the court if y'all care to review, in which we had a similar situation in which the person was, they did not object to the actual offering of the crack pipe. The appellant's attorney stated no objection, and the court ruled that it was still good law that when the prosecutor or when the defense attorney said no objection, that they waived that particular right. Now, they got in trouble in this case because the state got in trouble in this case because there was a requested jury instruction and the court didn't give the jury instruction to the case, and the case got appealed on that. Now, if I were practicing in this case, if I were the defense, I would have asked the jury to have a jury instruction on the voluntariness. But that was not done, and that was not raised on appeal. But just at the trial lawyer saying what I would have done, and it's easier sitting back here, I'm not in the heat of battle. But I think that would have been the best way of preserving error, is to ask for that jury instruction. So by not doing so, and by specifically saying no objection, I believe that point two has been waived.
I think that there's also, Court of Criminal Appeals has said that in that situation that we look to the record as a whole to see if it plainly demonstrates that the defendant did not intend, nor did the trial court construe his no objection to constitute an abandonment of a claim of error that had been earlier preserved for appeal. So I think that that's something that we would have to look a little closer at.
I understand. That's why y'all are where you are and why I am where I am. And I respect the difference greatly.
Anything else?
Well, like I said, the more I talk, the dumber I sound. So I just try to bring up the issues there.
I would disagree with that last point.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a privilege to be here today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. You have nothing further?
And no, ma'am.
There are no further questions, then we'll go ahead and let Mr. Stapleton conclude his argument.
Yes, thank you very much, counsel. Let me first say that I hope that counsel's mistaken about Rule 103 and Rule 104 as far as still needing to raise objections at trial or needing to do it during trial, because that's generally not been our practice or anybody's practice. We feel like that part of the reason to raise and get a ruling on these evidentiary matters is so that we do not appear to be obstreperous to the jury later when something's being offered. We will have already had a ruling. By the plain language of the rule, we're protected by that ruling. We've preserved the error, and that we do not need to, again, make an objection. I think that the careful reading of that rule comes to that conclusion. And that was actually, I brought that up again in the reply brief because I'm urging that if in fact you believe that we must still object at trial, please make that clear so that we can do so in the future. But I think that the purpose of the rule and the hearing outside the presence of the jury is so that we do not have to raise it. And then I want to comment on the sheriff real briefly as far as his testimony. He was so much involved in the investigation of the case, and it is arguable that it was not a very complete investigation, that it may have been a botched investigation, and they may have focused on somebody because they had a confession from him taken out in his front yard, and based on that the sheriff had a real interest in the case, both politically and as far as law enforcement, but that part of the problem that we had even on the state's affidavits that were filed, which we cited to, people said, well, he needs to, he can get a fair trial here because we have to find him guilty. You know, they had already decided the case, even in the affidavits. And I would urge that that was a general tenor. The main thing that I would suggest is, I have no doubt from reading the record that this judge is a pleasant judge and a good judge, normally would be a nice judge to try a case in front of. But his making a decision that I'm not going to decide a venue issue until I see if I can pick a jury circumvents the rules. And counsel is reaffirms the argument being made by state prosecutors, well, you've still got to have state action, or involuntariness is not to be considered. I think that's contrary to some of the Supreme Court decisions. I think that's contrary to the rule as it's stated. And so if that is, in fact, the rule, I'd ask that it be clearly stated so we know what we're doing as far as challenging a confession or statement. I mean, there's got to be a way to exclude a coerced statement by a co-defendant. I'll wrap it up with this. The two reasons given by the judge for his filing on venue, among others, were no other venue will take it, and this will save the defense travel expenses. Neither one of those have any basis in the law. I think that those were probably among his concerns. And I would just urge that we do have to be able to develop a venue argument, and I would ask for the opportunity to do that in this case as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case will be under submission. You're welcome to provide us the copies of the case law if you'd like.